This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday as we rapidly approach the Christmas holiday. Many universities have already sent their students home, and I think other schools will be going on break. So I wanted to spend some time today with you talking about men's health. My guest today is going to be Dr. Abe D'Amato. Dr. D'Amato is a urologist at the Men's Health Institute at Trinity Health of New England. He's going to be joining us at 11:30. So if you have questions for Dr. D'Amato about men's health, and specifically, we're going to be talking about urinary tract problems. We're going to be talking about prostate cancer, urinary frequency in men and women, which is a problem, and some talk about kidney stones. So hoping to get to all those topics in the second half of the program. After our first break, I'm going to play an interview that I did this week with my good friend, Father Rick Frechette. For those of you unfamiliar with Father Rick Frechette, he is a native of West Hartford, and he has been living in Haiti since 1987. And I have had the honor of working with him over the years. Unfortunately, since 2020, I've not been able to get down there. The violence has prohibited from many people to get there to volunteer, and it's a very dangerous place. So I had the pleasure of interviewing him in person. He was here in the United States for a short period of time this past week. So we spent some time, and I did a quick interview with him that we will play before the bottom of the hour. So I'm sure those of you who are regular listeners to our program will enjoy that. This day in medicine, December 14, 1916, Dr. Thomas Barr died. Now, Dr. Barr was a Scottish ear, nose, and throat surgeon, and he wrote a paper on the effects upon the hearing of those who work amid noisy surroundings. And this was really the first paper really written about the effect of a work environment impacting people's hearing. And it's something we're very mindful of these days, especially in factories, but also I notice at venues. For example, if you're at a concert at Mohegan Sun or another location, the ushers and people like that wear ear protection now because the noise is so loud, and you cannot have this constant exposure to loud noise without losing hearing. And many employers also have regular hearing tests for their employees. So again, it's something that was so long ago, but yet it's really at the forefront of OSHA and other work environments. He also wrote a paper on the investigation into the hearing of school children. And again, something we do today is really test children's hearing, because obviously a child born with a hearing loss is going to have difficulty learning. And it doesn't have to be complete deafness, but any hearing loss will impact their ability to learn. So that's why in schools, I know we always used to do hearing tests on a regular basis for young people, and I think that's part of the pediatric evaluation. So again, we remember Dr. Thomas Barr as an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and someone who really led the way in protecting our hearing. Now, a lot of you know how much I've talked about this and the importance of hearing and hearing aids and diagnosing hearing loss and treatment with hearing aids. And we've talked about that even last week in the issue of dementia. Well, a paper published just this week in JAMA Neurology talked about hearing loss and incidence of Parkinson's disease and treatment with hearing aids. So basically, this paper looked at hearing loss as an independent risk factor for people later developing Parkinson's disease. So it may, what they're saying is, oh, if you have hearing loss, you're going to get Parkinson's disease. That's not what they're saying, but hearing loss may be an early sign of Parkinson's disease. And remember, Parkinson's disease consists of a shaking tremor, bradykinesia, where there's just slow movement, there's abnormalities in gait, and rigidity when trying to move. So before you see those signs, hearing loss may be an early sign and something that can be remedied with the use of hearing aids. We're getting ready to see a surge, and in the midst of a surge, of pertussis cases and other respiratory infections. Now, pertussis is more commonly known as whooping cough, and it's caused by a bacteria, Bordetella pertussis. We think that it's often underdiagnosed. Not everybody ends up in a hospital or severely ill, but they will develop this intense cough. And it's very hard to get rid of. We have vaccines for whooping cough. That's why we try to protect children. But what we've seen is weakening of the vaccines and fewer people getting the vaccines, meaning fewer children getting the vaccines. So again, as a reminder, now that we're getting to the holiday season, many of us may be in crowds among people we're not familiar with, whether going to a show, getting in a crowded elevator, it's still worthwhile to carry a mask and think about using a mask because there are so many respiratory infections going around. Not all of them pertussis, but we see RSV and we see the usual respiratory influenza that will be going around. One of the things we like to talk about on this program is our life expectancy and how long we can live. A recent paper really looked at the real gap in life expectancy here in the United States. And basically, a lot of your life expectancy depends on your race and ethnicity, as well as where you live and your income. So obviously, those who are on the lower end of the economic spectrum and those living in isolated areas away from medical centers and easy access to health care will be on the lower end of life expectancy, to the point where there's a 20-year gap now. What's also interesting is that Asian Americans tend to live the longest at 84 years. While at the lower end of the spectrum were American Indian and Alaskan Native populations, that was about 63.6 years. So some of these factors you're not going to be able to change. And there are so many other factors in this. But one of the things I wanted to emphasize is where you live, because that's something you have control of. So many patients that I talk to look forward to retiring in their older years and moving to a remote area. I hear this all the time. We always wanted to build a small home in the woods and away from the city, away from a crowd. That's probably the worst thing to do as you get older. What you should be doing as you get older is moving closer to adequate health care, meaning a trauma center if you fall and get hurt, a stroke center if you have a stroke. Remember, time is brain, and you can retrieve clots and things like that, okay? Again, heart attack, quickly getting to a hospital can change everything. So this idea of moving to a remote area from a healthcare standpoint is not a good move. The other thing you're moving away from are family and friends, and access to public transportation. We're not going to be able to drive until the day we die if we live that long. Many of us are going to have to give up operating a motor vehicle and give up that privilege to be safe on the road. So obviously getting to a place where you may have more public transportation is key. So with that, we're going to take a short break. And then we're going to be back, and I'm going to play the interview I did this past week with my good friend, Father Rick Frechette. If you have questions for me or for my guest later today, Dr. Abe D'Amato, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds, and as I mentioned, we're going to play an interview that I did this past week with my friend, Father Rick Frechette. Father Rick Frechette being a Catholic priest who has been living in Haiti since 1987. He is not only a Catholic priest, but he is a physician and runs the St. Luke Hospital as well as the St. Damien Hospital, in addition to providing schools and education for 15,000 students, 15,000 children in Haiti, thanks to the St. Luke Foundation for Haiti. So with that, we're going to roll the interview. We're back on Healthy Rounds, and today I have the honor of being with Father Rick Frechette. Regular listeners to our program know Father Rick Frechette, who is a Catholic priest from West Hartford and has been living in Haiti since 1987. He is also a physician and has done great work there with the support of many of us locally. And I had the rare opportunity to catch up with him while he was visiting the United States. Father Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you to all your listeners.
You know, Father Rick, it's usually around Christmas time that I'm in Haiti getting to visit with you, but it hasn't been the case for the last 4 years. But once again, we're in the Advent season, and I have the honor of being with you. Can you give our listeners an update? You know, we get filtered information about what's going on in Haiti, but can we hear from you as somebody who's there as to the current situation in Haiti?
The current situation is an evolution over the past 4 years of increasing gang rule in Port-au-Prince and beyond. So probably at this point, the gangs control upwards of 80% of Port-au-Prince. Very heavily armed, military-sized weapons, very complex webs that are supporting them, international and local. And the forces against them, namely the police and the Kenya group, are frankly no match for them. So they're not making any headway in making the country more secure. So it's it's a reign of terror. It's destruction of buildings and houses and police stations. I think over 70 police stations have been destroyed by the gangs. How many houses? UN estimates 700,000 refugees internally. Big problems of malnutrition, closed borders, closed airports. It's a humanitarian disaster. And what's unfortunate about it is 13 million people in the country and 3 million people in Port-au-Prince area are subject to maybe 3,000 gangsters with big arms, big guns. So it's not like Haiti trying to destroy itself or Haitians trying to destroy each other. It's a criminal element with no pushback from anybody who can push back. That leads the population to be suffering under an oppression, which is clear in many countries right now, many other countries right now.
Father, how do you keep the hospitals running, the St. Luke Hospital and St. Damien Pediatric Hospital?
The challenges have been losing staff to the United States, to Canada, to France. I think all hospitals have pretty much the same attrition rate of 40% of our people, and our best people are all gone. But there are still people there. There are new doctors that have graduated that are looking for work. So the quality is reduced, of course, because experience is reduced, and mentors aren't there to give the right instruction and experience. Everything is so expensive, it has to come in special flights or from Dominican Republic with all kinds of taxes on it by different bandit groups that the vehicle has to pass through to deliver. So things are phenomenally expensive. Fuel is always in the... since the ports are controlled by the gangs, we never know if we're going to have fuel or not have fuel. So 30 some hospitals have closed already. Even Doctors Without Borders is currently closed because of police attacks on them. So your question is, how do we function? We bite the bullet. We do our best. Anything that's possible, we grab at it in order to keep the lights on, in order to keep the place staffed, in order to find the medicines that we need. Any possible way that comes along, we grab at it, and we make it work. So it's infrastructurally, it's a nightmare, but in between the cracks, that's where we're all working day and night, in between the cracks at every level.
You mentioned something. Why would the police attack Doctors Without Borders?
They're fighting with bandits. Bandits get hurt, bandits get brought to hospitals, and they want them dead. And that's understandable. But there is such a thing as the Geneva Convention, and things like the Geneva Convention ensure that there's a civilized way of waging battles, and that there are basic human rights met when somebody's hurt. So it's the police and even the population are in overdrive against the bandits. They have no tolerance at all, and totally understandable. So when ourselves or Doctors Without Borders or any other place is suspected of in any way, shape, or form of helping or harboring a bandit, then we get an attack. And it's understandable, but human race is in a lot of trouble. If our bloodlust and our hatred is going to get beyond some kind of norms that we all agree to of what is civilized, but certainly to finish off somebody who is wounded, just to finish them off, is not civilized. They should be restored to health, and if they can be restored to health, then face justice. But it's not. It's not summary execution because you're hurt.
Is there any American presence there? I mean, there's an embassy.
Yes, the embassy is a reduced function, and they're operating under I forget the proper terminology, but this isn't the right term, but it's like forced evacuations. In other words, only minimal staff can be there at the embassy. So services are greatly reduced, but yes, for sure, the diplomatic service is still functioning. The consular services are not functioning.
Father, what can we do? I mean, what can our listeners do? Is there something? I know now it's not possible for volunteers like myself to come to the country. What can we do to help you?
Be kind to legitimate legal refugees who are looking to make their life better and are trying to get ahead in the world. That's a big thing. Try to combat the hatred of the foreigner. And be generous as you can with anybody that's in trouble with our foundation or any foundation that's trying to help in difficult times. And pray for us.
Father Rick, thank you. Thank you very much for your time today, and thank you for all the work you do. We're back on Healthy Rounds, and my guest today is Dr. Abe D'Amato, a urologist at the Men's Health Institute at Trinity Health of New England. Abe, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk, can you fill our audience in a little bit about your background and, you know, where we started to see this confluence of urology and men's health and something like the Men's Health Institute?
Okay. So I grew up in Colorado and went to undergrad and medical school there and did my residency at Stony Brook University on Long Island. And subsequently moved to Hartford and have been practicing in Connecticut for the last 9 years. The real confluence between urology in general and men's health in particular is that about 70% of what we deal with in urology are men and men's issues. There are plenty of things that we see women for. I mean, kidney stones happen to everybody. Women have urinary issues as well. But as it turns out, those problems tend to be more common in men. And we end up dealing with a lot of cancers more specific to men, things like prostate cancer, and testicular cancer in particular, but even things like bladder cancer that, again, can happen to either men or women are a little bit more common in males.
So, for example, what makes up a men's health institute like the one at Trinity Health of New England?
So what makes our institute special is that we have a full breadth of care. So we deal with a lot of men's sexual health, starting at a young age with fertility issues or testicular cancer, which tends to happen in younger men. And it progresses all the way through as men get older and start to have different issues. We have programs in place to help with testosterone deficiency and erectile dysfunction and urinary issues, and programs in place to help funnel patients through screening to the finding the people with prostate cancer so that they get appropriate care.
You brought up an interesting topic, in that being testicular cancer in young people. And, you know, we've seen a lot of famous people. Lance Armstrong had it. I mean, and we see testicular cancer, even with metastatic disease, with spread of the cancer, yet is the survival rate much better now than it has been in the past? Have we made a lot of strides with respect to testicular cancer?
So in the 1980s, we made the discovery of the chemotherapy cisplatin, which was a complete game changer for testicular cancer. Prior to the discovery of that chemotherapeutic agent, testicular cancer was nearly always a death sentence. It's still a very aggressive cancer. It spreads easily. It's metastatic. A lot of times by the time we find it and begin therapy. So in the 60s and 70s, when we were starting to develop some of the new chemotherapy, it was still very difficult to treat. But once they found cisplatin, it turns out that the non-seminomatous, the mixed germ cell tumors, are incredibly sensitive to this one chemotherapeutic agent. So for men with that common or more common type of cancer, testicular cancer, even if it is widely metastatic, and you brought up Lance Armstrong, it's a great example. He had testicular cancer in his brain. It was widely metastatic, and it's curable. And that is one of the true success stories for science and cancer therapy. The difference between how we're able to treat the disease today and what was happening, when I was a kid, are completely different stories. Now there's a 97% cure rate, all comers, no matter what the disease stage is at the time of diagnosis.
Is self-examination still the best way to screen for it?
far and away. And then let's be honest, most men, especially in the age group that testicular cancer is common, that's late teens to early 30s, are fairly aware of that particular part of their body and probably doing more self-exams than is strictly speaking necessary. It's not a problem.
Let's move on. Prostate cancer is obviously a big problem in this country and throughout the world. Can you talk a little bit about some of the statistics or how big an issue is it?
So we estimate that each year there are about 300,000 new diagnoses of prostate cancer. Most recently, there are about 35,000 deaths a year from prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is the single most common cancer for men, and I believe it's the third most common cancer overall in the nation. One of the things that's happening with prostate cancer is, although some of the screening technologies, PSA is the main one, have been around for a very long time, there are some newer technologies out. Several companies have exams now that can be performed on urine. They can isolate prostate cells out of a urine sample and then do a genetic analysis of those cells, looking for changes in the genes, using that to help us predict how likely it is that somebody with an elevated PSA has cancer and needs to move on to more aggressive evaluation like a biopsy. And even on the biopsies these days, although we still rely heavily on the old Gleason grading system named after Dr. Gleason, who first developed it, by looking at the cells microscopically, we can evaluate how aggressive we think they appear. There are now, again, a lot of genetic tests that can be done that within those different grades of cancer do a marvelous job at helping us understand how aggressive the cells really are. So it's a much more exact science. We have a much, much better idea of which men are good candidates for what we call active surveillance, where they don't need any sort of therapy up front. We watch their numbers very closely, periodically image them, maybe repeat biopsies, but can avoid any of the invasive therapies and possible side effects associated with the cancer. So those genetic tests are helping a lot. Helping us find people that can get away without an aggressive therapy. And then even when men need to move on to therapy, now the use of robotic surgery is extremely widespread. That has dramatically changed the risks associated with the surgery. There's a much, much lower risk of significant bleeding. There's a higher rate of urinary continence postoperatively. There's less leakage. There's better erectile function after the surgery. So that has improved a lot. Now at St. Francis Medical Center, we're one of the only places in Connecticut that is offering CyberKnife radiation technology. Although the radiation is still the same as another way of treating the cancer by focally targeting the prostate, CyberKnife changes the game a lot for men, whereas traditional radiation therapy is done 5 days a week for a short session. You come to the hospital, you have it done, you go home and come back for about a month. CyberKnife can shorten that whole therapy session down to maybe 4 or 5 days. So again, it's giving men the same outcome with much less cost in terms of time out of work and stress and logistical problems trying to get this therapy accomplished. So those are some of the big things that have been happening. And on the horizon now are some even more minimally invasive therapies and focal therapies where we can use different technologies to target just part of the prostate where the cancer is, minimizing damage to the other areas in the hopes of eliminating trouble with erections and urinary issues postoperatively. So we're very excited about some of the new technologies coming up, the big one being high-intensity focused ultrasound, which is offered a couple places in Connecticut and will be coming to Trinity probably within the next year.
Quick question. I guess I think most of what you're referring to is really the carcinoma in situ, in prostate cancer, as opposed to metastatic disease. Have we made progress with respect to metastatic prostate cancer as well?
So that's another big area of research. The statistics that I had quoted with 35,000 deaths a year, that is probably going to start declining rapidly. We've known for a long time that prostate cancer is dependent on testosterone to grow, much like a car is dependent on gasoline to run. And by removing that testosterone, it's just like taking the gas out of a car, it just stops. Unfortunately, prostate cancer over time can mutate to the point where even very, very low levels of an androgen, not necessarily testosterone, but other hormones that are similar in shape inside of the body can cause it to grow. In the last decade, there are, I think, five new drugs out. Most of them are extremely well studied that are able to manipulate the testosterone even further. So they don't have any real side effects beyond what a man would normally experience with hormone deprivation therapy in metastatic cancer. Those side effects are still significant: fatigue, trouble with erections, loss of libido, loss of energy, weakness. There are issues with bone health associated with it. Those are common with any of the therapies we use for metastatic prostate cancer. These new drugs are remarkable because they prolong how long men can stay stay under control. In other words, they delay that mutation in the cancer. And these days, we have patients that have been on therapy for a decade with no obvious progression of their disease. So there are a lot of new drugs that are coming out that are dramatically changing how we treat prostate cancer, what we think the prognosis will be for men, even if they develop metastatic disease. And it's rapidly changing even metastatic prostate cancer from a lethal condition into really more of a chronic disease, on par with like diabetes, where you have to watch it, you have to monitor it, you have to do therapy to control it. But it's very controllable, and a lot of times that will mean that a man is able to live through his natural lifespan, dying of a completely unrelated cause.
Always a good thought and a good point. I have a question from Robert here. Is a rectal examination an essential part of a primary care exam every year?
So you're going to hear a lot of different people say different things about rectal examination. My personal opinion is that it is a good exam to do. It costs absolutely nothing. You're already there seeing your doctor. But we also know that the physical exam is highly practitioner dependent. Yep. So there could be a very big difference between the rectal exam that you get from a primary care who may not be doing as many of them or may not have felt as many positive results than you would get if you have a urologist do the same exam. But it is one of those things where it is highly variable.
I guess the point is really, can you feel a palpable abnormality and still have a negative PSA or a low PSA level? Because, I mean, that's that's where the problem would arise, I guess.
There are times where that happens. It's not super common that mm-hmm. we find prostate cancer without a rise in PSA, but they do occur. And sometimes those can be the more aggressive types because, again, they're not doing what we expect them to do. They're not producing that chemical the way that we would expect them to. So it's good if you're able to pick them up that way. Important thing to do. Absolutely. I can understand why guys may not be super thrilled about it.
No, understandably. But nevertheless, I think that it's an important point and a good part of the examination for thoroughness. Let's move on to urinary frequency, because I know that affects a lot of people, both male and female. Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit about the causes of urinary frequency?
So, again, this is a really multifaceted problem. The most common things that I tell people in my office, the diagnosis of overactive bladder is incredibly common. We see that an awful lot. It affects people from teenage years all the way through to the end of life. And overactive bladder is one issue. In men, it gets a little bit more complicated because we have to worry about whether the prostate is playing a role with blockage and trouble emptying. In women, we have to worry about a possible cystocele or loss of integrity of the pelvic floor and the bladder falling out of its normal anatomic position and contributing to symptoms. But there are some basic things that I remind everybody of when we talk about going to the bathroom too often. The first thing I remind people is that whatever they drink must come back out. So if somebody is drinking a lot of liquid, they will have to urinate frequently, and there's nothing wrong with that. But there are plenty of people who I see who are coming in drinking, 3, 4, 5 liters of liquid throughout the course of the day. And if you're doing that, you're going to have to urinate very frequently. For a standard adult, somebody who's not terribly physically active and sweating, an adult really only requires about 30 ounces of liquid for a 24-hour period. And that includes any liquid, whether it's coffee, water, soup, soda, juice, beer, wine, fruit, ice cream. All of that stuff counts. And it's sort of amazing how quickly you can get to that level. I always tell patients the easiest way to tell what's going on is the color of the urine. Now, that gets thrown off. A lot of people will take vitamins, and B vitamins will turn the urine very, very yellow. And again, there's nothing wrong with that, but it makes it a little harder to tell where you're at. If you're not taking vitamins, a good way to know you're okay is when you go pee, the urine should come out the color of lemonade. If it's more pale or clear, there's nothing wrong, but that's an indication of overhydration, just meaning that you're filling the bladder up very quickly, then you're going to have to urinate more often. And that's an easy way to titrate how much liquid you have going in and out. We also know that there is a number of different foods that might affect some people's bladder and lead to urgency and frequency. And those foods are something you can search online. We know that caffeine, even decaf coffee, and alcohol are very common bladder irritants. Some people are bothered by dairy products or spicy food. But again, if you were to look online for bladder irritants, there are huge lists. And not everyone is going to respond the same way to everything. And some people may find that they do fine with some foods and not others. But it's an easy thing to sort of moderate how much you're drinking and what you're eating. And then if you're really bothered by how often you're going, it's a good idea to seek help because we have a lot of different options, both oral pills, medical therapy to control symptoms, and then some surgical ways of helping really calm the bladder down to make somebody a lot more comfortable.
Abe, can people, I see patients all the time come in and they've got these huge water bottles, right? They've almost become like jewelry, okay? But they're carrying these water bottles and drinking huge amounts of water every day. Can overhydration put too much taxing on your kidneys? Can you do any harm by drinking too much water other than psychogenic polydipsia or some other mental health condition?
So there are rarely people who will get to the point where they're getting hyponatremia, low sodium levels, because of how much water they are consuming. But it really is in somebody who has a pathologic problem. I mean, these are people that are consuming gallons of liquid a day. It's not something that a normal person would be capable of doing. You would be markedly uncomfortable from how much liquid you're consuming.
In the last minute, can you tell our listeners one thing in the field of urology that they should know about that is not common knowledge?
Here I am talking about how, you know, you don't have to drink so much liquid, and you know, all the water can cause some of these other problems. But the other part of all of this is that kidney stones are a common issue. And the number one way to prevent stones is to hydrate. So, you know, there are plenty of people who are out there who are probably saying, well, I've always been told how important it is to hydrate. And so what I really want to do with this last question, rather than try to steer people the wrong way, is to sort of coach moderation, because there are potential downsides to not drinking enough, and there are potential downsides to drinking too much. Again, for most people, we're talking somewhere between 30 and 40 ounces of liquid, and that probably will keep them at a good balance in terms of their overall health, preventing other problems and avoiding having to see me because you're peeing too often.
Abe, thank you. Thank you for that information, and thank you for taking time out today.
No problem.
For those interested, the best way of reaching out is at 860-714-2990. That's the Access Center of Trinity Health of New England that's located in Bloomfield. Abe, thanks again for your time today.
No problem. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to my guest, Dr. Abe D'Amato. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board, and as always, Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, since we are an equally balanced program, we're going to be talking about women's health in orthopedics, and I'm doing an interesting interview this week with some orthopedic surgeons who specialize in women's care. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast. Just download it for free at odyssey.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.